I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. We begin today with Senator Ben Cardin, a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. With outrage at President Trump's performance in Helsinki still fresh, yesterday the president announced that he's invited Vladimir Putin to the White House. A Russian gun rights activist is in jail awaiting trial, accused of working on behalf of the Russian government, and Congress refuses to increase funding for election security. Senator Ben Cardin on what's next for U.S.-Russia relations. Plus, Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun on the latest developments in the police consent decree, a prison sentence for a state senator, and a local official grilled on gridlock by the city council. And we'll meet the new director of the Baltimore agency that organizes Artscape as the festival gets underway. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. On this Friday, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. It's the Midday News Wrap. Coming up a little later, Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun joins me for a look behind some of the big local stories this week. We'll also meet the new director of the Baltimore Office of Promotion and the Arts as Artscape gets underway here in Baltimore. It started about an hour ago. It ends on Sunday. Donna Drew Sawyer will join us a little later in today's show. But first, Senator Ben Cardin joins us. He's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, among other committee assignments. He's calling today on the road in Frederick. Senator, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for your time.
Tom, it's good to be with you. Thanks.
So Mr. Trump's performance in Helsinki, particularly at the press conference following his private meeting with Vladimir Putin, roundly criticized by Democrats. The criticism from Republicans considerably more muted. Before the president went to Brussels for the NATO meeting, the Senate voted 97-2 on a resolution confirming support for NATO. They voted 98-2 against the idea of having American officials be interrogated by Russian officials, people like former ambassadors. So the Senate is stepping up in some cases to counter some of what they're seeing with Mr. Trump and his handling of foreign policy. But is there more that the Senate can do? And what would you expect that we can see from the Senate moving forward?
Well, I clearly think the Senate needs to do more. What happened in Helsinki was a gift to Mr. Putin. I'm sure they're smiling in Moscow and they're scrambling at the White House. It is a major problem that was created. I thought the director of national intelligence, Mr. Coates, said it best when he said he would not have recommended to the president to have that one-on-one meeting in the format it took place. It was set up to help Mr. Putin. It was not under our terms. Russia is an adversary. They're not a friend. So I think the United States Senate needs to step up. Yes, we passed a resolution yesterday to make it clear that we're not going to let Americans be interrogated by Mr. Putin. The fact that the president didn't dismiss that out of hand is a concern. It never should have been even a thought that we would allow Americans to be subject to that type of interrogation. So, yes, we can step up. There's a legislation that we're looking at to impose additional sanctions on Russia if they interfere in the 2018 election. I have legislation that would make it more difficult for the president to eliminate the so-called Magnitsky sanctions, which came up in the Helsinki summit, where Mr. Putin asked to interview those that were connected to the Magnitsky law. So there are things that we can do to protect America.
Right now, what actually transpired at that meeting between the president of Russia and the president of the United States, the only notion we have of that are some reports in the Russian press. What do you think the Senate can do and should do to find out what happened in that meeting? Do you expect a briefing or some sort of report on the meeting, be it classified or public, from this White House?
Well, Tom, the director of national intelligence does not know what happened at that meeting, and he so stated yesterday. Yes, we must find out. The Congress has a responsibility to understand what happened in that one-on-one meeting, whether commitments were given. We need to do that as our responsibility as an independent branch of government. I think the only way we can be assured of the accuracy is to talk to the interpreter. look at the interpreter's notes. It should be done in a way that protects the confidentiality, but we should get the source material because, quite frankly, I don't know whether obviously the president's the only one who knows other than the interpreter, and it's unlikely we'll get a full briefing from the president.
Do you support Senator Shaheen's bill to basically compel the interpreter to testify before Congress?
I think we should work out a process where the interpreter comes before us, again, in a way that can protect confidentiality so that we have the source material to know what happened in that meeting.
That's unprecedented. No one can recall a time where that's happened in the past. Is that going to be a major impediment? Would that be breaking a precedent that you think might have long-term ramifications?
This president, President Trump, has broken precedent over and over again. He's not released his tax returns, the first president to do that. He has not complied with the emolument clause, the first president to do that. And the summit in Helsinki was unprecedented. Never before has an American president met with a leader, a dictator-type leader such as Mr. Putin, on a one-on-one session. So we've already broken precedent.
In terms of election security, yesterday the House voted down a proposal to increase funding to the states to provide more security in the way they conduct elections. Steny Hoyer from Maryland gave an impassioned speech on the floor of the House, ended up with the Democrats in the chamber chanting USA, USA after his speech. We found here in Maryland that one of the people who owns the machines that we use to vote here in our own state is in fact a Russian oligarch with ties to Vladimir Putin. What do you know about that situation? What do you know about the security that Marylanders can count on when we come to vote in 4 months?
Well, Team Maryland, including the governor and our delegation, has requested help from the Department of Homeland Security to understand exactly what this oligarch, this Russian oligarch, was doing, taking control of a company that provides a voter service here in Maryland. We know that Mr. Putin directs all types of activities to get into our election system. They've used cyber to break into election systems. We know what they did in the 2016 elections in an effort to try to generate support for Mr. Putin. We know that. So what we don't know is exactly what this intentions are for this purchase by this oligarch of the company that does business here in Maryland with Maryland voters. We need to know that because it's certainly part of Russia's game plan to find ways to penetrate our election system to compromise our free elections.
How do we find that out?
Well, there's ways of doing that. I mean, we need the investigative powers of the federal government to find out what we can through our intelligence sources as to why this sale took place, what this company has been up to, what this oligarch's been up to, the connections between the oligarch and Mr. Putin. We have dots. We need to connect these dots.
And do you expect, cooperation in that effort from this White House and this administration? This is a president who's been reluctant to acknowledge the conclusions of the Intelligence Committee. He was told about Russian interference in elections before he was even inaugurated in early January of 2017, yet he was defending Mr. Putin or apparently agreeing with Mr. Putin as recently as last Monday in Helsinki.
Well, one of the fundamental responsibilities of government is to protect our democratic institutions, including our free election system. So, yes, I do expect we're going to get help. But I can tell you this, if we don't get the type of cooperation from our federal agencies, I can assure you that Mr. Mueller's investigation, and I do not know what he is doing, and because that has been kept confidential. But I am certain that Mr. Mueller is following the Russia engagement here in the United States, and this is certainly on his radar screen.
There's a theory that part of the reason that the Republicans' response to Mr. Trump's behavior in Helsinki and in Britain before that and in Brussels before that has to do with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. They don't want to roil the waters before that nomination is considered and putatively passed. Do you buy into that theory? Do you think that one of the reasons Mr. Trump has been criticized so infrequently by Republicans, the folks who are criticizing him, frankly, are the ones who are about to retire? What do you see a link between that and the Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court?
Well, first, Tom, I'm mystified as to why there isn't a stronger response by the Republicans. We're an independent branch of government. What Mr. Trump did in Helsinki requires Congress not only to speak out, but to act out. So I am deeply concerned that there hasn't been a stronger response by the leadership of Congress, controlled by Republicans, to bring matters before the floor. I asked this week that we have a Senate resolution clearly repudiating what happened in Helsinki. And of course, there's been no response to that. As it relates to the Supreme Court, it is kind of frustrating because, you know, every week there's another major story coming out of the White House. This week, of course, it's the Helsinki summit. Last week it was the Supreme Court. The week before that, it was separated children. All these are important issues to follow. The Supreme Court nominee is a critically important decision that must be made by the United States Senate. We need to totally vet Mr. Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh's record. I took the floor yesterday to speak about one of my concerns, and that is the protection of our health care system. Judge Kavanaugh ruled in the case involving the Affordable Care Act that gives me concern as to whether he will protect the law as it relates to pre-existing condition exclusions by insurance companies that prevent people from getting full health care coverage. We're concerned about how Judge Kavanaugh would be in regards to a woman's right of choice. We're concerned as to whether we would have an independent voice on the Supreme Court to protect your rights against the abuse of power, whether it's the president, the Congress, or corporate America, particularly in light of Mr. Kavanaugh's opinions as to the power of the presidency. This president wants to take all the power, and we need a court that can stand up to him. So absolutely, it's critically important that we have an independent Supreme Court that will act as a check and balance in our system.
Have you made a decision as to whether or not you will support Judge Kavanaugh's nomination?
Well, I've raised these concerns. I go through a process. I have not yet had a chance to meet with Judge Kavanaugh. I will take advantage of that. Of course, the hearings haven't taken place. So I will let the process go forward, but make no mistake about it. I have very serious concerns about this nominee based upon his record.
Some are suggesting that it's in the Democrats' interest, at least politically, to delay this process so that at the very least, it doesn't take place until after the midterm elections. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is hypocritical. He said 11 months was not enough time before an election for President Obama to have a nominee considered. And now he's using just a few months as adequate time for President Trump. So he's certainly being hypocritical. I don't believe we should delay the nomination. What I think we should do is take the time we need to make sure we get all the information we need. And I would hope that every senator would recognize how important this vote is. And let's see what happens. But I do believe we have a responsibility to get all the information out to the public so the public understands exactly what's at stake. And I will take advantage of every procedural opportunity I have to make sure that information gets to the public before we vote.
Back to Russia, Senator. A young woman from who was a student at American University and a gun rights activist from Siberia, Russia, Maria Butina, is in jail as we speak, awaiting trial. She's been accused of essentially being a Russian spy. It seems that she's had some efforts to infiltrate organizations like the NRA, lobbying groups who work with Republican causes. And now we have the president surprising everybody, including Mr. Coates, the head of the DNI, with his announcement that Mr. Putin has been invited to the White House. What do you make of that invitation? Should the U.S. government pursue it? Should it be rescinded? What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of what you just asked. We don't know what happened at the Helsinki summit, so we certainly should not be scheduling another meeting between the president and Mr. Putin here in the United States. We first need to find out what happened in Helsinki. In regards to the indictment that was brought down in regards to the Russian operative here in the United States, working, by the way, trying to infiltrate the National Rifle Association in order to influence our elections, That is of major interest. And it came at the same time that the Secretary of the Treasury announced changes in our election laws that will allow contributors to these types of organizations to go unreported. There's a lot of dark money in our political system, which is wrong to start off with, but it also can shield foreign influence in our elections. And we got to make sure that does not happen. So Congress needs to respond to make sure that we know where the money is coming from in our elections, particularly since we know we're vulnerable from foreign infiltration, particularly from Russia.
Senator Ben Cardin is the senior senator from Maryland. He is standing for re-election in November. His Republican opponent is Tony Campbell, a lecturer at Towson University. Senator, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much, and have a good weekend.
Tom, thanks, and have a good weekend. Great.
Coming up after a break, Baltimore Sun reporter Luke Broadwater joins us for a look behind some of the big local headlines of the week. I'm Tom Hall. It's the Midday News Wrap, which continues after a quick break. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday, water has become a lot more expensive here in Baltimore City and in some surrounding counties. There's an ongoing dispute between Baltimore County and the city over what the county owes the city and whether or not county residents were charged the right amount for their water use, some of which is supplied by Baltimore City. It's complicated, and on midday Monday, we're going to take a look at water affordability. Some experts estimate that by next year, as many as half of Baltimore's households may not be able to afford their water bill. Mary Grant from the Public Water for All campaign and Delegate Mary Washington joined me. Plus, Kamau High of the Afro-American newspaper joins me for the Afro check-in. That's coming up midday Monday. If you just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. Now let's take a look at some of the local stories that have commanded our attention this week with Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Sun. Good to see you, sir.
Good afternoon.
So just yesterday, Mayor Catherine Pugh announced a big grant, $30 million for a project that's also a very big project in the Perkins Somerset Old Town neighborhood. This is a grant that was highly competitive, and this is a pat on the back for Baltimore, isn't it?
Yes. The mayor is very excited about this. This is part of her plan to really remake a lot of East Baltimore. This has to do with actually completely transforming the Perkins homes into a mixed-use development that would butt up right against Harbor East there. There's an old housing project that had been torn down some years ago, the Somerset Homes, that would build a new, also mixed use. It's supposed to be mixed income project up north of there, and also redevelop the Old Town Mall. So this is this would be a complete dormant forever.
Yeah,
this would be a complete transformation of a lot of East Baltimore, including a lot of the vacant properties that are over there right now and a lot of the rundown properties.
Yeah, this is a HUD grant. Only five cities got them. Very competitive. We got $30 million. This really could transform that area in a huge way. I mean, we're talking about Harbor East all the way over to Hopkins. I mean, that's a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there has been some concern. I covered this issue when the plan was, proposed some time ago. And there was some concern about displacement and where will the residents of the Perkins homes go. And the city has made a lot of promises about not displacing people against their will and making sure everyone has an affordable place to stay. But they say that the Perkins homes is so run down now and in such bad condition that it's really almost irresponsible to allow those conditions to continue.
Yeah, and it seems that they've sort of learned their lesson from the Hopkins development, EBDI, over by the hospital, in which a lot of people were displaced, and there was a lot of people who, you know, really disagreed with the way that took place. So it looks like they've taken that to heart. The mayor made a point in her announcement to say the folks at Perkins, you know, as you say, if they want to stay, they're going to be able to stay. There is going to be affordable housing mixed in with sort of what they call market rate housing and retail stuff. And so let's hope that it works out. want to talk about the consent decree. That's, of course, been in place now for a while, more than a year, between the Department of Justice and the Baltimore City Police Department. The district judge, James K. Bredar, he's in charge of overseeing this, and he had some reservations about the Baltimore City Police Department's capacity to comply with the consent decree and to meet the requirements. He didn't seem particularly optimistic about it.
Yeah, this was a good story by my colleague Jessica Anderson. The judge overseeing the consent decree focused in on the fact that we've had three police commissioners now in Mayor Catherine Pugh's very short tenure, and he expressed a great concern in the leadership of the police department. And we have all these promises that where we want to reform the police department. We know the police department's in desperate need of reform, but is there enough stability? Is there the right leadership to get that job done? And so these were the things that the judge was saying in his written remarks. The mayor said on Wednesday that she had put out a job listing for candidates from across the country to apply to be the new police commissioner. And she said she hoped to have a permanent police commissioner, whether that's the acting commissioner Gary Tuggle or somebody else, within the next 60 to 90 days.
She certainly didn't do that the last time. She was over here right after she appointed Daryl D'Souza to replace Kevin Davis. And I asked her point blank, did you do a search? And she said, nope, I just picked him. And we know how that worked out.
Right. And for those who don't know, obviously he had to resign after failing to file his tax returns.
Yeah, for three some years. So the judge did say in his written remarks, the court does not doubt the department's good faith, meaning the police department, but it has growing concerns about its ability to deliver on its promises. So this is exactly the thing that the monitoring team was put in place to oversee. And there's been some news with them as well. Your colleague, again, Jessica Anderson in the Sunday Sun last weekend, there's a task force that's reviewing civilian oversight of the Baltimore Police, and this task force is basically calling to blow up the current method and process for oversight of the police department and sort of start over with a whole new plan.
Yeah, anybody who's followed police oversight over the past 10 years or so knows how ineffective it has been. Right now, we have a civilian review panel, which really has no power, that is supposed to be watching over the police department, but their recommendations carry no weight of law, and they have very little funding and no real investigators to do anything. So taking a look at this, the federal judge is saying, we need real oversight here, and we need to set up a real system where something has some actual power that could hold police accountable.
Of course, it's probably not surprising that Gene Ryan of the Fraternal Order of Police thought this was a bad idea, but also some people in the administration, including Jill Carter, who before she was elected or won the Democratic primary for senator, she is unopposed in the election in November. She'll be heading back to Annapolis, so she's left her job. But she thought that the civilian review board doesn't need to be tanked completely. It can be tweaked. Where does the city stand in terms of what they think?
Well, right now we have the civilian review board and we have the civilian oversight task force. So I think what the feds were recommending is that do away with the civilian review board because it's ineffectual. I think what former Director Carter would like to see is the civilian review board actually be empowered. Don't get rid of this body. Give it some real teeth. And so that's sort of a, you know, They both, I think, want the ultimate goal to be the same, which is actual empowered civilian oversight of police. It's just which body is the right body to do that.
It ain't cheap. I mean, this is a multi-million-dollar price tag to start from scratch, to have investigators, to have, you know, a director, to have subpoena power and all that kind of stuff. But the people on this task force, Ray Kelly from the No Boundaries Coalition, who's serving on this task force, has said, look, it's a minuscule percentage of the entire police department budget. The city council, speaking of the police department budget, had held hearings about, again, you know, the continued abuse of overtime. I mean, people call it abuse. The police say it's necessary, but there's an awful lot of overtime being spent by the police department, way, way above what is budgeted for overtime. Where does it stand?
Yeah, that's correct. Last fiscal year, the one that just ended last month, the the budget for the police department's overtime was $16 million. They came in at $47.2 million. So when you talk about cost overruns, that's a pretty huge one. Jack Young, Brandon Scott, Councilman Pinkett, others on the council have really grown tired of this. And they said, instead of waiting for the for city stat or the mayor or someone else to rein in these costs, we're going to start having monthly oversight meetings. So you can expect the city council over this next year to be, I think, a lot tougher and show a lot more scrutiny on police spending. Of course, you know, the police department says we are severely understaffed in patrol, and so we have to do this overtime. It's the only way we can keep up with the staffing patterns that we need. So, you know, I don't know about how much oversight will matter without the necessary hiring or restructuring of the police department. So there's got to be both things.
Because people have for a long time pointed to the exigencies of the contract between the police department and the state, which actually runs the police department, oddly enough. And they just say that it's baked into the cake, the way the shifts are allocated, the who has to be on duty and who gets to be off, and how many hours they serve in each shift, that kind of thing. Do you know anything about any progress in the talks concerning the police contract and whether or not it can be that the contract itself can be restructured, which a lot of folks say would help this overtime problem mightily?
Yeah, I don't know where the talks are or the negotiations are at this moment, but I think both the union and the police commissioner have agreed that things are not working as they should. The union says we need a lot more staffing and patrol. I think they like the shift schedule, but they want it to be staffed correctly. And then we just have, as Kevin Davis used to always point out, we have 500 fewer police officers than we did only a few years ago. And so the mayor has said she wants to increase hiring. They haven't really done that. That's been more of a goal than an actual
We hear occasionally that there are a few more graduates in the police academy.
Yeah, a little bit more.
But it seems very incremental.
It's very much in the margins, and it's not if you think that's the problem, if you think we need many more police, as some do, they're not making progress on that. I think other people would think we don't need more police. We need to police differently. But that's a different discussion.
With the police and its standing in the community, the trust, particularly in communities of color, between the police department and those communities, do you see any change? Do you see any evolution? I mean, we have this consent decree. We had the GTTF trials in which, 8 officers were convicted in this gun trace task force. When those convictions came down, people in the black community in this town said, "Told you so." I mean, we've known about this forever. Finally, some action has been taken against these folks, but we think that the problem is considerably more endemic than just those particular 8 officers. You're on the street all the time covering this town. What do you see?
Oh, has the relationship between police and community gotten better? I mean, well, I don't see how it could get worse. It may have gotten marginally better over time. That's really hard to quantify. I wouldn't say I've seen any noticeable difference. We do know police are arresting a lot fewer people, which probably leads to fewer negative interactions. We always talk about going back to Martin O'Malley's days when 110,000 people were arrested a year. I think last year it was about 30,000 people, or maybe even 25. So yeah, I mean, if you have a gigantic reduction in arrests, like has been done, I assume there'll be fewer negative interactions with police. But I don't see people going around saying we love the police now, we didn't before. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I'm not seeing that either. Luke Broadwater is a terrific reporter for the Baltimore Sun. If you got a question for Luke Broadwater about stuff Baltimore, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @midday WYPR. Speaking of the police and its efficacy and the what appears to be a considerably lower arrest rate, there was this bizarre story of a firefighter who saw a gun being stashed in a bush downtown and called 911 to say, "Hey, I've just observed this. Send somebody out." What happened next?
Well, the firefighter was told, "That's not in my district." And that is the kind of response that really infuriated the acting commissioner, Gary Tuggle. But sadly, from what we hear from many residents, it's not an uncommon response someone in power, not just police, but often many times you deal with different agencies in city government, they say that's not my issue and they're not really helpful. But when we're talking about a loaded gun, when we're talking about potential threat to public safety, you never want to see an officer say that's not for me.
Do we have any notion of how the police department has handled this situation and any disciplinary action taken against that officer?
I don't know. I
haven't heard any.
I assume there was, given Gary Tuggle's response, but that wasn't a story I reported, so I don't know all the details.
Fair enough. We have an email from our good friend Charles Robinson over at MPT. He says, can you ask Luke about how Catherine Bennett Jones and the Change for Real group reacted to the grant award that was announced yesterday? This is a grassroots group who expressed concern about the inclusion from residents and the displacement of public housing individuals. Now, I'm not sure you covered this.
I wasn't at the press conference yesterday. Yeah.
But do you know anything about Catherine Bennett Jones and the Change for Real?
Well, not specifically, but I did talk with many residents. I wrote about this, I think, about a year ago when this was proposed, and I went out and talked with a bunch of people. And there was concern at the time about displacement. I don't know to what extent those fears have been alleviated. The city had talked at the time about tearing down building by building in the Perkins homes and then letting people move to new buildings if they want to stay in Perkins, or move up to the new Somerset building or elsewhere with a voucher. Obviously, if your apartment gets torn down, you're being displaced even if you're moving next door. And that can be unsettling for folks. But then I also talked to a bunch of people there who said, please move me. I can't wait to move.
Yeah, I want
to
get out of here.
Yeah, so, I heard both opinions.
Yeah, there's certainly no monolithic response. Nathaniel Oakes, appointed to the Senate, served about a year, had been in the House of Delegates for a long time at one time, left the House of Delegates because of some corruption scandal, and as Britney Spears would sing, oops, I did it again. I think it's Britney Spears, one of those
that is Britney,
girl
yes.
singers. Okay, well, you're an expert in Britney Spears. God bless.
She's my age, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So he gets a 3.5-year prison sentence. He's 71 years old. The judge could have given him as many as 15, I guess. What's the reaction to the length of time that he's being?
Yeah, I was in the courtroom for that one. His lawyer made an argument that others who did much worse were punished less. He pointed to Governor McDonnell in Virginia, who had taken something like $170,000 in gifts and loans and things, and he got 2 years. That ultimately was overturned by the Supreme Court. Nat Oakes took $15,000, and he said, he thought maybe it was a little bit harsh, but Nat Oakes walked out of court smiling. Went out to lunch afterwards with his friends and family. He'll report to jail in, 2 months. So he didn't seem terribly upset. He wouldn't talk to me, but, I think what the judge was really more upset about than him taking the money was the FBI was conducting a sting investigation here, and they were going after
more
people.
Which then Mr. Oakes tried to impede.
Yes. Yeah. And so Mr. Oakes, pretended to go along or maybe was going along with the FBI. He learned everything they knew about who they were going after, agreed to wear a wire, and then tipped off people. So that's what really annoyed the judge. And even though that wasn't what Oakes was convicted of, I think that was the reason the judge gave him that sentence.
I think I can speak for at least part of the group, and when I say it annoys us too. Jessica in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Luke Broadwater.
How are you?
Good.
I'm calling about the article that I read in the newspaper this morning about overdevelopment in Woodbury and Clipper Mill specifically. The residents there are wanting to keep the PUD, and the investment firm who purchased the commercial property is asking the councilman to repeal the PUD. And we have a petition together with over 800 signatures asking the councilman to keep the PUD.
Luke, you know anything about this?
Yeah, this isn't my story, so I don't know all the details of it. But I can certainly put you in touch with that reporter.
And the PUD is what?
It's a city ordinance that was passed in 2003 to define the zoning specifications for the neighborhood. This investment firm has come in and said, we want to put buildings, more buildings, and not commit to developing the one building that we were expected to have developed under the PUD.
All right. Well, thank you, Jessica, for that, for mentioning that. And as I say, we can put you in touch with the reporter for The Sun who did that story. And, you have successfully stumped the panel here because Luke and I don't know that. So Jessica is going on to our grand prize round, evidently.
I write many of the stories in the paper, but I don't write them all. So I'm not an expert on every single topic, but just basically the ones I write about.
All right. Fair enough. But I appreciate you putting that on folks' radar screen, Jessica. Let's go to Chris in Baltimore. Chris, welcome to Midday with Luke Broadwater.
Hi there. Thank you.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I was just calling. You were just talking briefly about the firefighter who saw the guy stashing the gun in a bush. And I just want to relate a couple of experiences I've had, and I guess myself and one of my friends. She was experiencing somebody leaving threatening letters on her front door, and she called the police and got the response, "What do you want us to do about it?" And I essentially had the same exact response when I was witnessing a group of young men taking hammers and crowbars to an Escalade that was parked in a parking lot. They replied with pretty much the same phrase, "What do you want us to do about it?" I believe both of those were calls to 911.
All right. Well, thank you for that perspective, Chris. The police have a tough job, and they're not going to respond to every little thing. You hear stories like that, and you think, well, gosh, they should have responded to both of those things.
Yeah.
But, every story is different.
Yeah.
Don't know any of the other details.
I was talking with a friend of mine who said, that's not in my district. I thought was the name of certain officers I've talked to, because that's all they would ever say to me. So I think what you're seeing and what we saw in that video is a very common complaint in Baltimore, where many people feel like they go to the police for help and they don't necessarily get the customer service that they wish they did.
You wrote a story about an estimate from the Department of Legislative Services on what it might cost to have a single-payer health care system.
This is
something that Democratic candidate for Governor Ben Jealous has recommended. There's also a story in the Sun about some questions that have arisen concerning Governor Hogan's real estate holdings.
Those are two stories I did write. So.
So but tell us a little bit about those as we finish up here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let's start with Governor Hogan. Since he's been governor, he's made about $2 million in income outside of his salary. And he has, before he went into office, he was quite a big pretty ample real estate developer throughout mainly suburban Maryland. He entered into a trust agreement with trustees, most of whom work for his company, and that business has continued to thrive. They've done about 20 different land deals since he has been governor. And so,
is this one of those blind trusts where putatively he doesn't know anything about what they're doing? So, a transportation project that he might recommend or some other policy issue, he would not necessarily know whether or not it's related to any of his holdings?
Well, so no, it's not set up as a blind trust. He has pledged in the trust to have no involvement in day-to-day operations with the company, but he can receive information about all kinds of projects and how financial they are, or financially successful they are, according to this agreement. And so this has caused Democrats, especially in election year, to say, isn't this awfully similar to President Trump with his business that's also named after him, run by relatives, and not in a blind trust where, he can know what it's doing? And is there any way that maybe And to what extent should the governor wall himself off from his business to the more so than he's been doing? As for the article about the cost of single payer health care, this is one of candidate Ben Jealous's big proposals. He's going to be a big ideas guy. He's got you know, free college, legalized marijuana, single payer health care, big ideas that would change the state in some dramatic ways. Some analysts at the State Department of Legislative Services ran some numbers on how would you actually do a single payer system. And they said it would to do it, you'd probably have to increase the state budget by about $24 billion. That's a huge increase. And you'd have to impose some new taxes, about a $2,800 tax on each person. So I felt that was important information for the public to know, because if you pay more or less than $2,800 for healthcare right now, you should know whether or not this is a proposal that might be in your financial interest. You know, I think my wife and I pay more than that. So $2,800 might be per person. Might be a tax that some people would be okay with and others wouldn't.
All right. And we will, of course, ask Mr. Jealous about that. We have invited him and Mr. Hogan to be on Midday to talk about it as the campaign continues. All right. That's all the time we have. Luke, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Great. Thanks.
Luke Broadwater is an award-winning reporter for the Baltimore Sun. He covers City Hall and local politics. We've got a link to Luke's reporting on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up next, Artscape kicked off about 2 hours ago. Here in Baltimore, we'll meet the new director of the city agency that produces Artscape, Donna Drew Sawyer. She joins me after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.